My name is Judy Madison. I suppose I'm here mostly because I'm a writer and have done considerable amount of retreats and public speaking and that sort of thing as a result of those books, and have done some teaching. And in the last 5 years or so, I've really been concerned about and interested in lifestyles, possibly on my partly on my own motivation, and also because of a very good editor at Augsburg. A few weeks, John and Mary Schramm have taken this spot, which leaves me a little nervous, feeling a little inadequate, because they're so well schooled and they've thought through this first steps in lifestyle change so well. And I thought today what I'll try to do is integrate some of what they do with some of the style that I use, and then what we'd like to do is follow it up tomorrow with what will be a more, shall we say, practical, hands-on kind of experience. Maybe something that you can even take back with you, ideas and materials and that sort of thing. That would be tomorrow. But let's begin today by looking at what we are in the middle of. And not all of us are so sure we're in the middle of it yet, and that's changing times. I mean, there's a whole magazine by that name, but it means something else, probably. We're in the middle of changing times, and it means that our values are kind of up for grabs, and a lot of us aren't so sure what our values are, I think. We haven't clarified that in our own minds. And that means we have new vocabulary to consider, and I want to look at some of that vocabulary today first. And I made a list on this side of the board of some words that, for me, are important. And you can use other words for them, but let's think about that first word, finite. We use the word infinite quite often, especially within the church. But the word finite is something we've lost our identity with to a large extent, because in our situation there's always been the availability of more of whatever we wanted. Within this culture and this country and this part of the world, we can have pretty much whatever we want, and we can have it when we want it, and we have been deluded into thinking that it's always possible to have more. And for the last, at least 20 years, people have been telling us otherwise. You know, there were books on world hunger. In 1950, there was some major work out, but we didn't really look at the population explosion and world hunger until almost now. Finite. Things end. I've written a poem about it that says, what is it that is finite? It's oil, it's coal and other resources, and it's me. My life is a finite thing. I do not go on forever, even though I'd like to think so. Another delusion. It isn't a question of whether the oil will run out. It's just a matter of when. Is it going to be the year 2000, or is it going to be 2025? Coal lasting only slightly longer than that. Those resources are finite. This little book, which I will use from time to time, is called Food, Fuel, and Future. It comes out of, I have to say it right now, Parish Life Press in Philadelphia. It's been written by persons in the Virginia Synod, friends in fact of the Schramms, and is a good study course for beginning awareness in this whole area of food, fuel, and our futures. Let me just mention to you something that most of us weren't so aware of, and that is how much we rely on the rest of the world to maintain our so-called infinite wealth. The United States now uses the following percentages of the world's goods. Of aluminum, we use 42%. Coal, 44%. Copper, 33%. Petroleum, 33%. Natural gas, 63%. Iron, 28%. If we went further than that, we know that we can't make steel with just the iron that we use. We need alloys that come from all kinds of other countries. What we're becoming aware of is that we are interdependent people. We don't live alone anymore. We are not the great, strong, isolated nation that we thought we were. It would appear, in fact, that we're easy to blackmail right now. or maybe you don't see world issues the way I do. It looks that way to me sometimes right now. We have to stop and take a look at our view of life and ask ourselves about what it is to live in a finite world, a world with finite things. Oh, I made the mistake of not writing down the number of the page this is on. Basically, I'm a poet. That means that I try to say things in as few words as possible, so then it's easier for me to use my own material because it goes faster. We are descendants of pioneer travelers who saw open land and limitless space as something to be overcome, subdued, and filled. Blessed with much, they took it, used it. We, like they, expect to find more. More space, more trees, more water, more things. We claim our territory, our section of land, and demand our privacy, our personal space, although it is no longer limitless, but a luxury. We expect wilderness to survive without planning. We consume voraciously, ignoring the needs of posterity. We buy bigger, add on, expand, and then we fill our extra space with things and wonder that we use so much energy replacing things and making more. Jesus understood that life is simple. It is relationships, love and anger, cooperation and listening and time. Space and separateness are not superior to knowing each other better. Space is a luxury of temporary withdrawal. Life is love close together. Finite is one of our new worlds. Limits. We have limits on ourselves. The whole Testament is about a rebellious people telling God, "Don't put limits on me. I want to be who I want to be, self-sufficient." And God over and over tells us, "No, I am the infinite one." A second key word in my view, you can hear I'm is transition. Are you as afraid of change as I am, as a rule? Some of us are more honest about our fear of that. I had long hair for a long time. And first of all, it was in style. That's when I first let it grow long. And then it became me, and I was afraid to cut it. And it was inconvenient as the dickens. Whatever vanity said was opposed with the amount of time it took to wash it and dry it and fix it. It was a big bother is what it was. But to cut my hair was like taking part of me away now. I had sunk my identity into that long hair. It was a very difficult transition to begin to cut it, and I only cut a little at a time. And I see heads nodding because that's what we do, just a little at a time. And then perhaps it was the reverse a few years ago, letting it grow longer a little bit at a time. We're not accustomed to change. We prefer the familiar. It feels more comfortable to us. But we are, in fact, in an age of transition. A lot of us think in terms of the year 2000 as being a time when we will have made a significant transition. You know, that seems a long ways away, 2000, except that it's only 20 years away. And I only graduated from high school 22 years ago, and gee, that went fast. I can't get over it. The age of transition is what we're living in now. And I think it's going to force us into a lot of priority decisions. We're going to have to do a lot of balancing. Some of that's going to require more knowledge than most of us have. Have most of you read a lot of books on the energy crisis and the world food distribution and all those things? Let me see. Oh, some have. Good. We're on a start. I haven't. Or I hadn't. Mary's got book. I'll tell you a lot of books tomorrow. But she's got a pile of books in there that are wonderful to read to help us deal with transition. After all, when we don't understand little babies, what do? We dig out all these books, and our elementary school children, too. children the challenge. Between parent and child come to mind. We read to find out how to relate to these little giants that live in our homes. So it is we are in a transition in our values, in our culture, in our economies, in our worldview. And maybe we should be reading more about it. Maybe we have to consider whether or not it's more important to use petroleum for polyester clothing, for fertilizer, to help feed especially the parts of the world that need the fertilizer a great deal, or for power boats. Maybe on a day-to-day basis, we have to check our priorities on whether we're going to feed those who need or our greed. Our past history has been to solve the kinds of problems we're into with more production. At least the history that we are most familiar with. It really isn't necessarily a long-range history, but our short-range history. And it has worked. Just produce more and sell more, and it'll all work out all right. I would like to suggest to you that we're in a new time. We can no longer self-sufficiently produce and solve problems, because now we're more interdependent. Now we have a world that says, we'd like our share. If we're going to keep production up, we've got to have a few friends. And even our best friends have been telling us very recently they aren't really impressed by the way we've cut back in energy use here. Europe has made its voice known. And to produce takes energy. There's an energy cost for everything. Shall we produce plastics? Oh, plastics are so popular now. You can go into the store and get everything for the kitchen in this plastic stuff. And it's kind of neat looking. I like it because it's colorful and it's open. Then I say, but plastics are made of petroleum. Are there more valuable plastic products that need to be made? In an age of transition, priorities will be thrown up over and over. I kind of think about the basket going up in the air. And what will blow away in the wind, and what shall we keep? We should keep the grain to feed the world. And getting back to that change, that's our third word. I think we don't like change very well. And one of our typical responses to it is to try to conquer it. And that goes with our whole culture, too. We conquer the mountains, we conquer the West, we conquer the Native Americans, whatever it is. And now we buy snowmobiles and we conquer undriven snow, untouched snow. I'm going to go out there and make the first tracks. Gee, I hate those things. They're so noisy. But that's our mentality. Because, you see, we had so much in this culture. We had so much land. It was so available to us. It's no longer limitless. And conquering change is really a frustrating experience because it doesn't work. Rather, we have to learn to live with change. We have to move with change. We have to recognize it perhaps as an opportunity instead of as an adversary. And that takes a whole new way of thinking. And that's part of the transition, is to change our thinking, to change our view of the world. To change, in effect, our sense of values. If we make the choice now to begin to change those things, we open up for ourselves a lot of alternatives. Lots of them. In 20 years, this creative people that we are here and our leadership could do a lot of things to make life exciting and fair and good for people. Because we'd have time to experiment with alternatives. But if we wait, we may be pushed into a corner. I have an image. What's your image of something being pushed in the corner? I kind of think I see these little rats and mazes and stuff. And they get over in the corner, and how do they behave? panic very often. I'm kind of worried about the person who panics, especially if he or she is in leadership. And leadership is sometimes distributed rather widely. If we panic, we could make some very short-sighted decisions. I wonder what the car industry thinks about that idea. And we could make some hasty decisions, and I'm worried about that. I'm worried about the fact that nuclear power is so close and so available. And I kind of worry about the fact that a guy like Idi Amin, wherever he may be, could make hasty decisions based on an anger. I don't give him a lot of credit for having a good head. There are people in our midst and outside of us who can make a lot of hasty or angry decisions if we're in a state of panic. I'd rather start now. Oh, but I start to sound like doomsday, don't I? And that gets scary, and we start to feel our stomachs sort of tighten up. I learned a lot in the stress lecture last week. And I know that's where it happens to me, right here and right here in the arms. They get tight. That's because my finger hands are like this. And perhaps this is where we begin to change ourselves. That's, it seems to me, where it starts. To acknowledge what place we're in right now. Some of us are in a place of bliss. We don't even know really what's happening. A lot of us, maybe. You know some people like that? And some of us are in a place of fear. A little scared of the kinds of things that I've said, because we know our lives will have to change. And we aren't real sure how it's going to happen. We can't predict. And some of us feel guilty. And both fear and guilt sometimes immobilize us. We find ourselves standing still and going nowhere. I've seen that in a friend just recently, in the midst of the possibility of change, job change, unable to move for a while out of either fear or uncertainty, unable to take risks. So we have to change ourselves, I think. We have to see things differently. And this would be the first thing that John and Mary would tell you. We have to try to see things in a new way, a biblical way. I have a little sign in my office that says, we do not see things as they are. We see things as we are. And we find that true, don't we? Good political discussion, you'll find that always. We see things as we are. How are we today? The Bible suggests to us that we have a shalom view. I've kind of just gotten acquainted with that here. Shalom has meant for me, as it means for many of us, peace. And we sing it in songs and so on. But the larger meaning of shalom is wholeness. And wholeness starts here. A sense of who I am and what my purpose is. Why is it that I am alive? How do I fit into all of this and all of you? Oh, how scary it is sometimes to think of ourselves so small. And at other times to recognize we think of ourselves as so large. And to put all of that somehow into perspective, to have a shalom view. Shalom means more than that, though. It means understanding that you and I and we are all part of a whole. And it's in an interesting place to be. There's so much diversity. And that's the fun of sitting down with a lot of different people at dinner here. And finding out where they're from, and then getting farther than where they're from. I'm from Minneapolis, so I'm far away. But finding out who they are. And what it is that worries them, and what it is they like, and what it is they get out of their work that keeps them going. Take a little extra time and ask the questions about the inside of us as well as the externals of our life. That adds to our shalom feeling about life. I thought our devotions this morning were really good in that way. To recognize that we are alike. We have something Now, can we take another person from outside our culture altogether and understand that they too have feelings? That my friend who lives in Switzerland and is my age has feelings and concerns about her children and her world, and sometimes is a little angry with me because when she was in my home, I could wash any day I wanted to. She couldn't do that. She shares a washing machine. And I had a huge refrigerator. I want you to know I'm proud of myself. We got a little one now. You'd be surprised what you can do. I had this monster in my kitchen, and for one thing, it was just plain too big and in the way. We'll talk a little more about that later. And she has a small one, and one more person than I have, and they all eat a lot more than my boys. Can I understand that she is a person, that the person in India, with whom I have very little sense of identity, is a person? All of us part of a universal whole. All of us part of shalom. So that the decision I make does in fact affect someone else. The Bible talks about, and help me now, John, if I do it wrong, about the nest with a bird and mother. And we take, if we need to eat, we take only one, we leave the other. And the fields that were cultivated, we leave the excess, leave those things that fall on the ground for those who will need it. For the poor, for the widow who has no fields, for those whom we are in charge of, who we take care of, who we care about. Such is not our way of life. Have you read The Grapes of Wrath lately? I am just so glad that somehow I missed that 20 years ago, because I picked it up this summer. And there it was, people coming west and wondering why it was that there was food left to rot in fields when they were so hungry and couldn't work because it wasn't profitable to a company to work, to have workers, to pay them. Grapes of Wrath is a marvelous book. You might try it. It's a novel besides, so that always makes it easier. Leviticus has a terrific chapter. In fact, it's dealt with here in Food, Fuel, and Future 25. It talks about the year of Jubilee. And it talks about what we would call good farming these days, that every seventh year, seven, that's always a recurring theme, isn't it? Every seventh year, we leave the fields alone. We leave them fallow. And we don't worry about whether we'll have enough. We will have had enough from the year before, for the seventh year and for the planting of the next year. And we do that because we honor God, the giver of all of that. And then on the year of Jubilee, radical as it may seem, everything that has been purchased, which is every 49 or 50 years, everything that has been purchased during those previous years is given back, and slaves are set free, and things are made right again. And that way nobody really, well, you know the expression, the rich get rich and the poor, bless their hearts, they get children. Ellen Goodman said it so well this summer. More and more of that is true. The year of Jubilee turns that around, and so Jubilee takes on wonderful new meaning for us. Maybe we should use it some more. Let's celebrate Jubilee, where the slaves are set free. And there are a lot of different kinds of slavery. And one of them, I'm convinced, is the one where all I have to look forward to is hunger. Where I am robbed of hope because someone else is making different priority decisions. The New Testament, I think, is full of a new view. The rich young ruler went away from Jesus. Huh. Sad. Wait. I have children. Jesus, how often you have heard me say, children, share. You must learn to share your toys. But how sharing am I? Well, I never mind sharing my second best at rummage sales and garage sales and clothing appeals. but I don't always give away my preferential items or money in sums of noticeable sacrifice, the use of my properties or my time. When it comes right down to it, we keep for ourselves our boats and our cars, our power tools, our favorite recipes, our backyards, our tax monies from tax poor areas, our churches from youth who might make it look lived in, our holiday tables from non-family members. We find sensible rationale for our reluctance to share. Maybe that's why sometimes the children do not share. In fact, they may be doing better than I. I remember how the rich young ruler went away from Jesus, sad. I think I understand why. Help me change. It takes a new way of seeing to make that kind of change. It takes a new understanding of wholeness. It's a nice feeling for me to say wholeness, to see a world that would be whole, and to see people that become whole again. If we could see that as our direction in years of transition, it would give hope instead of fear. If we could see it as the right thing to do, it wouldn't seem so depriving. It would feel good. A book called Enough is Enough, the author's Taylor, talks about what is enough for us. Now we who live in this limitless economy of ours, what is enough? I liked what Mary said about this is an economy of insatiable needs. And it's true, it's just run on consumption and fuel. And sometimes we lose track of that, or I do anyway. I like John's idea of how many shirts do you have in your closet, or blouses. I set up this little group, and we were doing this at Richfield Lutheran, and we said, let's all go home, and we'll count our clothes. And some people went, oh no. They knew what they were for. And other people thought that was kind of a neat idea, and so we did. And one had the freedom to share or not to share after you got your data together. And some people brought in a lot of clothes to me the next week to be distributed elsewhere. Of course, there's always a risk there that we only give our second best. But at any rate, and some of it I get, I'm not too happy with, I might say. But from this group, we got a new awareness of really what's enough. And I think the point is that until you sit down and count and make some decisions about that, nothing happens. We sort of just go along thinking that we have, oh gosh, I really have too much. And besides, it just complicates the morning because you don't know what to choose. It's so much better being in Holden. Well, even at that, the suitcases are entirely too heavy. But I don't have as many choices, and it's a whole lot easier, a lot quicker. I get extra sleep when it comes right down to it. That's called replacement values. To find a different reason for doing something. Now, if I think of giving up clothes, that's really kind of threatening, sort of, in a way. After all, it has satisfied so many of my emotional needs to be able to buy clothes whenever I felt like it, and to change colors and seasons and all of that stuff. But if I begin to think of how much less complicated it would be if I didn't have to have so much, I have replaced one value for another. It's kind of like the person who starts running, a smoker. And you start running, and pretty soon you discover your values are in conflict. Now you still have the pleasure of smoking, but you're beginning to wonder about your achievement in running. It's not doing what it could, and smoking becomes lower on your priority list. Hopefully, eventually, you stop smoking because your priority has changed, your value has been replaced. Health is more important to you than unhealth. Is there such a thing? First, we have to recognize ourselves, and I would like to suggest that we've all done this. Passing by the item in the store was difficult. because it was on sale. Lyrics. It grew large before me, all its uses, the beautiful colors, the unique design, and my desire to have, possess, acquire, purchase, grew to an emotion-charged pitch. I approached the sales clerk only to discover that I could have two for even more savings. Two! I began to plot how I could use two. Where I could store them.
Yeah.
Who I could tell. And to compliment myself on thrift and wisdom, being in the right place at the right time. Suddenly I knew. Wrong place, wrong time. I really didn't need one, certainly not two. I was trapped in bondage in a free country to the desire to have more and more, to satisfy emotions rather than needs. I redefined. Wisdom was really my wanting, and my thrift was simple greed. I walked away. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong reason, wrong God. But we're kind of caught in that movement, in that race. And gosh, it's nice to get up here and get away from it, but we will have to turn around and go back. So I suggest that we have to be more aware. We have to start with here, and we have to look at things a little differently. Could we have a biblical perspective? Could we carry the replacement value of the whole world, shalom, with us when we go back? So that when we make these little decisions about whether to get new when the old is still wearable, we have a sense of doing it for something more sure, something bigger and better. It would help. And it would give us, I think, a sense of our own integrity. We see things as we are. And we can't exactly run away from that. So we could, as in the sermon last night, we could delude ourselves a little bit and pretend that we aren't who we are. That's a nice way to do it. We could say, and we do, oh goodness, I'm not rich. And some of you who were in my session on Saturday, remember we talked about this just briefly. I'm not one of the rich ones, for goodness sake, the rich ones are, and then we have our list. Someone told me the other day how many millionaires there are in this country. It was appalling. But you know, $20,000 a year isn't bad either. Wealth, rich, is other people, with enough to spare, to spread around. I will not claim wealth. It requires responsibility, sharing, giving, gratitude, satisfaction. I prefer striving, increasing, reaching for more, gaining, claiming I'm still so far behind others. Today, I shall pile upon my camel all of my possessions, gifts, and talents, and count them one by one. Will my camel fit into the tiny needle's eye? We have so many lessons about rich and poor. It would be nice to avoid them, but if we see ourselves as Christian, and I think we do. I think we want to. I think it feels right to us. If we see ourselves that way, then we see the world differently. And if we have integrity, it means we've been able to put together how we behave, how we hope to behave, how we profess to be and to believe. And of course, the beauty of all that is that when we miss, and we always do, we're forgiven. And that gives us the hope to keep trying to go on again. To work towards some sort of integrity. I think of Jesus as this as the person of integrity who put all of life together somehow so that we would understand. And I think that you will find living that way with our replacement values, which will turn out to be very practical, that we will also have a sense of shalom, unvarnished. I stripped a piece of furniture to its natural wood, removed layers of shiny varnish, dirt and dust of years of use. The wood beneath was fine, solid, true. I stripped my life of its unnecessary varnishes. I kept my family and closest friends, a simple home, basic food, knowledge that I'm able to contribute to the world, a part of God's plan, a reason to live. And stripped of all the other things, lobster with melted butter, matching end tables, a boat and a new car, and a ring to remember our anniversary, the substance remained. Solid, true, fine, unvarnished, good. To replace the kind of life we lead with those things would seem to me would be a first step to have replacement values. And we can talk more specifically, especially about that tomorrow. Now I've discovered that I have more time left than I expected. And I could open it to questions because I know John's here.
Okay, I'd like to start out by saying that I don't disagree with anything you said, but I'd like to raise some more points of interdependence. One of the things you mentioned was Detroit. And just speculate for a moment that we all decided, well, we really don't need two cars, or in some cases three, and we could drive our cars longer. And what would that do to Detroit? It would make them change their minds. I think we've lost sight of the fact that Detroit is thousands of people working who have families. And we can make all these sacrifices without having to worry about losing our job, our sense of identity, that which, in a sense, holds our family together in this society. And what do we as Christians have to say to these people in Detroit who work in the automobile factories? Or in all the other factories in the country that make these consumer goods? How can sort of our, maybe it's a sense of guilt, a vision, or whatever, how can we change our lifestyle? And face it, where do you live here? We're white, we're educated, we're middle class, we can afford to make these changes. What can we say to the people who can't afford to make these changes?
I have a response to that, but I encourage other response.
Mm-hmm. I guess one thought I have on that is, thinking of all the technology that Detroit has, if we're going to single them out, and all the things that need to be done in the world with their expertise, their engineers, their designers, their financial organization. So perhaps if people start saying, I can do it with one car instead of two or three, and you know, Detroit starts to feel, you know, they can go two ways. They can react to that and get into the ratty corner you were talking about.
Okay, but those changes take time, and in that transition there are people who have lost their jobs, some are older and they never get jobs again, they have lost their sense of identity. And what do we have to say to the people who are caught in this kind of frictional change in our society? We think this change is bright and has certain value, but what do we have to say and what do we have to offer to these people who are caught in our new vision and are going to be hurt, at least in the short run, by our new vision?
If we're dedicated to this change, you know, then I think we also then have the opportunity to offer alternatives. We're saying we're not going to buy a second car because you could do this with your technology. And by the time we all slow down, they can pick up.
But technologies and workers, what she's talking about is labor.
I mean, look what's happening.
Along with minimum skill.
How many thousands are laid off now?
Yeah, he has to somehow find a way. That's not Detroit, that's not technology. It's just talking about those people. How do we react to their needs? By cutting back on Arkansas.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to. We have two responses back here. You can take this one. Many of the changes that we've been discussing, I've been hearing since I arrived Saturday, involve nearly painless choices that we make. I haven't heard anybody volunteering to be part of a guerrilla group of administrators or executives in large businesses where many of us do live our economic lives to help make decisions at that level that can respond to the situation that people who are laborers dependent week to week on us, on the offer of a job, that can make the kind of decisions and choices and open opportunities for them. We haven't talked about that as far as I've heard. And I think there's a real need. I know Sweden has the label of a socialist nation, but a large corporation may not let a person, a worker, go at any level, whether he's an engineer or a first-year mechanic, without providing him either with the opportunity of another job or retraining. Sweden has a lot of problems with people who love to come in and live on the welfare system and pay the check that comes in. But at the same time, many of the working people know they have a participatory investment in the big businesses that they're working for, partly for that reason.
That's a good example.
One of the things that I think of in response to putting people out of jobs by buying only one car is, and I use that to stop myself sometimes from doing that, I think, on the other hand, that my answer for that is to say in my words and my deeds, I love you, I care about you, and I will share what I have with you. Instead of buying my $10,000 car, I will give to my church $10,000 this year. And I will also, within my church setting or within whatever setting I want to give that to, direct that be used within our country to help displaced persons. I think that there are lots of alternatives that we have, and the freeing of my resources by not having a second car not only conserves our resources in terms of our environment, but I think also can be a tremendous people resource. So I think there are some very real and very solid things that we can begin doing rather than stopping ourselves by saying, if I don't buy a car and everybody in this room doesn't buy a car, then we're going to put 50 families on the welfare line.
Yes, because this kind of thinking, we would then still be subsidizing stable rooms, you know, periodically down the road, and carriage houses and living rooms. But a lot of these things that you've discussed us can consider relinquishing are something that are of fairly recent origin. They aren't a birthright with a long-standing tradition. They are within the past 20 or 30 years, these fuel-intensive or petroleum-intensive products and activities, the way we use grain to store it in animals and then eat it because of a surplus of grain that was created 20 years ago. Things that we think we can no longer do without or relinquish or will destroy the balance if we change are of fairly recent origin. And so the process that over 20 or 30 years built us up to where we can't live without them, it shouldn't be that difficult to go down the other side and start relinquishing them again. Plus, these kinds of things that we would consider doing don't give me the feeling of who am I, one little drop in the bucket against all this greatness. A lot of the kinds of conservation changes are to be made individually, can be made individually, and make an impact.
Sometimes we do lose sight of the impact that we as individuals can make in a sense of a big world, which we see more of now. We get feeling powerless and forget how powerful we are. Some of us more than others. That man just took control of his whole week. that by witness and example, in fact, we do make a powerful statement. I sometimes fear apathy because we do say, there's nothing I can do, and minimize what it is we do do. John?
I think some of the responses are good, and I think that's one of the critical questions, however that's shaped. I think that's one of the critical questions. I think it's possible for us to have lifestyle changes as a groovy middle class fad, not realize that the first ones to suffer from a cutback in the automotive industry is not the president of General Motors, but somebody from West Virginia who went up there to work on the assembly line. I think it's a real question. I think there are some responses that indicate our way of thinking or our way of seeing. I don't really listen to that reason for not doing it from anybody who's not taking care of today's outcast, whose life has not shown that kind of interest in the one suffering today. In other words, I think you can kind of bust through the motivation for the question as to whether it's really a concern for the poor or a new justification for buying the second car by the present activity of the one asking the question. How concerned are you by today's people being crushed? Secondly, there is in some people's raising of that question the assumption that what we have in the world today is established order. I think what we have in the world today is established disorder. The present system that has us making cars is keeping 2/3 of the world hungry. You simply can't say don't tamper with this system because everyone's doing well. That's simply not true. So part of your view is how big is your family? I think another issue that the question raises, and at Holden we tend to have sessions, first steps of lifestyle changes. Unfortunately, all of you, most of you, will be gone in a week. We really don't have time for some of the critical ones like have come up today. But one of the next steps of lifestyle changes, if we can go beyond it in the one session we have, the answers are more radical than we get to in a session on first steps of lifestyle changes. For instance, I think we have to call into question capital-intensive economics and maybe be talking labor-intensive economics and helping that assembly line worker to realize it wouldn't be defeat to start farming a small farm again in West Virginia that he left. I think that's one of the answers for the future is more people back to the mountains on marginal land and fewer people to the supposed heaven of the assembly line in Detroit. But that's a more radical, and in the transition of that, there's going to be the need for some people who are going to get displaced, and the ones least able to take it will be the first ones hurt. Yes.
And let me suggest that the idea that we work a 5-day week and 8 hours a day, and that's our right and our privilege because we need to earn X dollars in order to be sufficiently supplied, could come into question. And we could say we could work a 6-hour day, we could work a 4-hour day. Our personal gain may be less, but we may give a job to someone else. So we talk about job sharing now, or arrangement of hours, so that even that gives us a better lifestyle so parents can share being home with their children in a different way. And neighborhoods can share childcare, those kinds of things. Creativity, it seems to me, is a real important part of this. Creativity does not, it seems to me, come, so far it hasn't come, unless we push ourselves in some direction. And then I agree with John, we have to be willing to pick up the load. We have to be willing to be concerned about the person who's unemployed. I don't know about you, but in Minneapolis, the food shelves right now are empty. That does not make sense to me. But the church, if I may make one more statement, the church is a place where we hone values, where we talk about the meaning of life. And we've said that there's no other institution that can do it like we can do it. And we could be the example, either in the way we interact as a community or the way we serve. The church has a chance, I would say, in the transition time to take leadership instead of followership that we have assumed. To be the creators. And I do think that to some extent we could look back at what people did 50 years ago and 100 years ago, and perhaps the history of a social active church like the Catholic Church, to see how do they meet the needs of people and lead the way. I see that as a marvelous opportunity of transition. Dave?
I haven't lived in the States for the last 7 years. I've only been back about 6 weeks. And so I'm still going through some observation and evaluation processes about what has happened to America in the last 7 years, in terms of I haven't been following along and getting into the latest kind of popcorn popper and the latest design of automobile and the latest bad gimmick. And it really hits you, coming back, how consumptive we are unconsciously. Your poem about the atom in the shelf, for instance, and how easy it is to get, I'll use the word privilege, for lack of a better one, by the momentum, the glacier of American society, that we're really all caught up in it. We can hardly help it. You know, and you're crying out for, what are we going to do about the poor guy in Detroit who needs his job, and should I take it away from him by not buying the car? Now, I think the issue is one that, you know, in personal conscience, you have to start to deal with how you want to make your own statement. At the tension between your own self-preservation and your responsibility to a societal group. And that's why I like the idea of starting with something like some sort of group. I think John mentioned it, using your church group, finding people that are of a similar way of thinking in a way, or at least trying to answer the same question.
Yeah, I just like to clarify that I'm not arguing for buying a second car. Yeah. I'm arguing that we sometimes forget the interdependence in our society and the fact that because we're free to change values and embark on this new lifestyle, that there are people who are going to get hurt and we just can't laugh them off. And welfare is not the solution. I mean, you've got to be much more concerned about what happens to the people who are going to lose their jobs and be caught in this transition and be changed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, very valid. Tomorrow, we'll look at more in this area and some specifics. Sometimes I like to make us aware of exactly how caught we are, as Dave talks about, and how it undermines our process. I'd like to talk about justice and injustice, only I won't do all the talking tomorrow. Well, I didn't do quite all of it today. Let you share out of your experience, because yes, we do need support from one another. We need a sense of community where we can be into this thing together and struggling with it together. It's going to be a struggle even in our thinking, in our view. But I'm very hopeful about it, because I think the church has something to offer to us. I think our faith has something to offer to us in terms of direction, reinforcement, and hope.